You are listening to Faithless Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Rogue. Each week, we design new decks for tournament play. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. This week on the roundup, are Modern and Pioneer the best they've ever been? Then on the flashback, our testing results with Basri Ket, Speaker of the Heavens, Stormwild, Capriter, and Nine Lives. Finally on the brew session, Transmogrify, See the Truth, and Discontinuity. All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faithless Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to episode 68 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, joining you as always from sunny Minneapolis. And I am joined as always by my guy on the left coast. He is Damon Alexander out of Seattle. Dan, what's going on?
Hey, left coast, best coast. Things are good out here. Had a bit of a heat wave, but it seems to be dying down. And summer's going strong for another not that long.
Yeah, August is flying by here.
Yeah.
Sadly, I don't know what happened in 2020, but I'm sure they'll be writing a lot of history books about it. The man who will write the history for this podcast is, of course, our CEO. He is Caveman Online. He's a lodestar of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. Dan Trever, what is up?
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Not too bad. How is the Deep South treating you?
Deep South.
I mean, I've been pretty under the weather lately, so I don't know, maybe the South doesn't agree with me or something about the summer heat. Like, the sky will just open up and it'll start pouring and then it'll return to being sweltering and humid for the rest of the day. I don't know.
Well, North Carolina's decided that this isn't really, there's no COVID thing happening. So if you got sick, it has nothing to do with that. It's probably some sort of biblical ailment of some kind.
Yeah, like a miracle, it will go away, Dan, I promise.
Well, I'm having nasal swabs stabbed deep up my nasal cavity just in case. So hopefully all that will be well. We'll see.
You got to get that Mayo test, man. Saliva. You don't need to be jabbing anything up your nose.
It's too late. It's already done.
Well, I mean, you also got to, you know, feel alive. So so before we get to the regularly scheduled programming, we, of course, at the top, like to do a little housekeeping. We would like to welcome our two new patrons. They are Trevor C. and Pip Roberts. Love that name, Pip Roberts. So welcome Trevor C. and Pip Roberts to the Patreon. Just a reminder that access to the Patreon grants access to our Discord. There's all kinds of deck ideas and memes and GIFs flying all over the place. A lot of times you'll see little previews of the decks that we end up talking about on the podcast. Some decks we never even get to talking about on the podcast. In addition, some sweet screenshots and opponent salt in various chats, etc. So lots of things happening on the Discord.
We had a funny question from one of our listeners, Jason. He asked whether none of us, neither Damon nor myself, just had the heart to tell you, David, that the word is patron is the person who signs up for the Patreon. So you become a patron by joining the Patreon. And I said, yeah, basically. It's been like months now. We just let you say whatever you're going to say. Three new Patreons. Thank our newest Patreons. Although today, of all days, you said our new patron.
Well, it's like, it's not a real thing. It's an internet thing. So you can just make up new, you know, phraseologies and stuff. So it's like GIF, JIF. It doesn't really matter. You just make up a word and then make up a pronunciation. And then, you know, it's like an in-group, out-group kind of thing.
Yeah. In David's defense, when I saw this message in Discord, I was like, oh, I didn't really know that either.
Well, welcome to all of our new patrons and our new Patreons, new and old. Patreon.com/faithisbrewing is where you can sign up if you'd like to come hang out with us in Discord and throw us some support. We really appreciate it.
I only have respect for Patreons because that is cool. A patron, if you don't know, you know. Come on. So yeah, welcome to Trevor C. and Pip Roberts, however you designate yourselves. Now to the latest and greatest. So we've had bannings in Modern. We've had bannings in Pioneer. Damon, where are we right now with these formats?
It seems like we're in a pretty good spot, weirdly enough. I'm not going to say much about, you know, Legacy or Vintage. I think Legacy has this card, Allosaurus Shepherd, coming out of Jumpstart, which has made Elves good again somehow. You can look up that card. It has a lot of text, but not text in Modern. Modern, it seems like the best deck in terms of finishes is this blue-red prowess deck, which I guess we were all skeptical of. And then as soon as you start looking at a Lightning Bolt, Swarming Entity, you start to have second doubts. And apparently lots of people have had second thoughts on those Lightning Bolts, or they've had them countered by a Lava Dart or a Gut Shot or Mutagenic Growth. Not many cards kill the Storming Entity, it turns out. And then, yeah, we have Uro decks. Goldfish just calls them Uro Piles now because it was either blue-green with black for Fatal Push, blue-green with white for Teferian Path. You know, the sky was the limit with how you could form your other 71 or 91 cards around Uro. And it still is. But you see those decks sometimes with, like, a Breeding Pool, a Watery Grave, Two Islands, and a Mystic Sanctuary. And they can't cast Uro off of that. And that's a major change, whereas before they'd also have three Astrolabes, and it's effortless. So it's nice to see that deck is at a sort of more fair part of Modern. Yeah, other than that, I mean, Modern is wide open. There's, like, you know, Burn, Gruul Midrange. I've seen a lot of the Red Black Prowess deck, which I guess survived the Lurrus nerf. They simply have to pay three mana like they the rest of... I won't say like the rest of Fair Magic cards. That still isn't how Fair Magic cards work. But they have to pay three mana now before they get Lurrus in play. I've seen a lot of this Amulet Titan for some reason. I actually can't really explain that other than Boyle is just in everybody's sideboard now.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, Boyle was a card that has been legal since Modern's inception, but wasn't really used. The joke used to be you really couldn't play Control. And if you did, you were playing all kinds of crazy cards that weren't islands because you were, you know, you had your four Celestial Colonnades, and that was always a joke, right? People would have all these screenshots of Hogak, and they'd have 20 power in play, and their opponent would have a tapped Celestial Colonnade, and they'd say, all right, it's your second turn. Because Control couldn't do anything, but Force of Negation plus Uro really gave fair decks a chance against these combo decks, and I think it's really discouraged a lot of the more linear decks that can't hold up to interaction. Force of Negation by itself has seemingly really minimized the number of Neoform type of decks. You just don't see them very much anymore. It's just such a free win for all these blue decks. So it's been really nice. And Uro encourages games to go longer. So even these like fast burn decks are still playing, you know, something with a little more stick-to-itiveness. One of the things about Blue-Red Prowess, I mean, that Scry 2 really does matter. I think, you know, we talked about would it matter or not. I mean, I think it's actually been really important. You can see that deck grind into the mid game even. So, yeah, I actually think, I don't know if Modern's ever been better than this.
One thing that's really surprised me is the card Elder Gurgoroth from M21, the 6/6 for 5, has just been showing up first in small numbers and then larger and larger, and now as a 4 of in the 5 drop slot in like these Ponza decks. I couldn't quite figure out why, but I think it goes back to what you were saying, Damon, about the Storming Entity. It has kind of like immunity from all removal. It's almost like if you're immune to push and bolt, you've got like true name nemesis stats, essentially. You just can't kill that card outside of like Path to Exile. It still seems like really greedy, but am I missing something? Like,
I mean, I've been advocating for Elder Gurgoroth as like a one or two of in Pioneer for a while. I'm a little less convinced of its efficacy in Modern. I think that Glorybringer is a little better just because you want to be fast. Playing Elder Gurgoroth, letting them attack with Uro, and then trading is a pretty bad time. They've already gained two cards, not to mention if they draw a path or something. Also, like Teferi bouncing it. I mean, it doesn't have a come into play ability, so it's actually bad against other Planeswalkers, but it is good against decks that don't have Planeswalkers. So I guess if you knew what you were going to play, then you could always pick the right card, but that's not how we get to do it, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think a lot also just comes down to the fact that there's a lot less combo. Like, clearly against any sort of combo deck, Gurgoroth comes down on turn 5 and then hits for 6 on turn 6, maybe a little bit earlier if you have mana elves. But it definitely doesn't come down swinging quite as fast as a Glorybringer does with haste or any sort of other, you know, similar 5 drops. But without much combo, this card, yeah, it's really hard to kill. Only Path to Exile or Supreme Verdicts are the real clean answers to it. Teferi Bounce is annoying. This deck typically doesn't really worry too much about Teferi just because they play at sorcery speed anyway. Seasoned Pyromancer between the Pyromancer itself and the little elementals just can close out the one damage against Teferi to make it so it's just a kind of a repulse more than a, you know, repulse plus an extra static ability that's hanging around. I'm a little surprised to see it in these high quantities in main deck. I would have thought it kind of plays a Thrakdos role on the sideboard. But there's also a lot of prowess decks out there and burn decks, and this card will close those games out. And as, I mean, Vigilance, Reach, and Trample, this is a, you know, yeah, it's kind of true name status. You can't really block this card.
It also has, it's like a mirror breaker. It's actually very good against Glorybringer. They have to exert. You can choose not to block that turn if you have the life to spare. If you don't, you at least get to just straight up trade with it and draw a card or get a 3-3 or gain 3 life as you see fit. So I think that red-green Ponza is, you know, a tier 1 deck. I actually think it's, you know, if I had to make my top 5 decks in the format, it would probably be in that top 5. And so a card that's good in the mirror and that's good against a reasonable swath of tier 1 is maybe the way to go. I know that this sort of Ethervile Titan deck was even playing like 1 in its 5 slot as a tutor target. And that was specifically a hedge against Prowess. So,
what is an Ethervile Titan deck?
I don't know. I thought it was kind of a meme. And then I don't know the gentleman's name.
F. Paulus, the last modern streamer, as he calls himself.
The last modern streamer. Yeah, people should check him out if you like. He streams every day. He's kind of a character. He plays a lot of Amulet Titan. You know, a lot of the innovations we see in that deck often sort of originate from him or originate from discussions on his stream. And I think he wasn't liking it for whatever reason. I'm certainly not an Amulet Titan player. And he starts playing this list that has 4 Ethervile and the 1-mana 1/2 elf that taps 2 mana to sack a land and tutor a land into play.
Elvish Reclaimer.
And then this weird, like, 3 Thalia, this crazy mana package. And yeah, he's just been tearing it up. I mean, he posts his record at the end of every day, and he's like 55 and 12 with it or something over the course of like 10 days. Somewhere in the 82% win range, he just goes 4-1 over and over and over again. So at first, I think people were kind of laughing at him, and then I was watching Spike just get crushed by it. He's like, wow, maybe this deck is just sweet. I don't know what to say. So maybe this is why you're seeing Amulet Titan anymore, Damon. People are experimenting with Ethervile Titan.
Yeah, apparently. The deck makes no sense to me, but one of these days I'll have to either play with it or play against it and hopefully see the light.
It's a really, really weird deck.
The big insight he had was the Thalias, I think, which line up so well against these blue-green piles. Just all the cards I want to cast over and over again, and they don't play a lot of removal, so you're just kind of forced to spend mana after mana, and Path, which is the removal that these Bant decks want to play, is really bad against a deck that's trying to trigger Field of the Dead or Valakut with the Dryad in play.
The deck just looks like Maverick from Legacy, but without the Wastelands, which are a critical part to these green-white decks. Ability to scale against the big mana decks. And Aethervile with the curve that goes from 1 to 6, like, it just doesn't make sense to me.
I can't say I quite understand it myself. And I will say I'm not a regular watcher of the stream. I started tuning in just because I was kind of interested. You really have to be a master. I mean, we're talking about someone who's played these Amulet Titan lists, and so he knows all these lines intuitively, and of course he designed the deck, so knowing which lands to fetch with your, you know, elf on turn 2, and he's like, oh, I have a win if I get to untap here. And I'm just like looking, staring at it, you know, like the Bobby Fischer chessboard. Like, don't move till you see it. I have no clue how he possibly has a win. And neither does an opponent. They always like kill the wrong creature. He's like, that wasn't right. And I was like, I have no idea what the win is. And then he does like 17 game actions. And then the other player's like throwing down. It's just, you know, it might be like the first, you know, 20 times you play Inverter, you take the wrong card or you don't realize Thought Seizing that lets them, you know, dig a turn earlier or whatever. And you know, if this deck does become common, maybe I'll start to understand it better. But he won, like, on turn 3. He's like, oh, I'm going to beat Tron when they, like, resolve their turn 3 thing if they don't exile the right, you know, thing with their Karn. I'm just like, what is going on here? This game is over for them. And then, of course, he won, like, 3 turns later. I was just like, yep, I I would be, you know, 0-4 and saying the deck is bad. But you can't really disagree with those kind of results, at least. So
we'll put a link to the deck since this is one of those. I can't even, like, picture the 60. I've seen, like, iterations of it. It just looks like Ethervile's, Elvish Reclaimers, and then, like, nothing. And then a bunch of 3-drops, just random 3-drops. And then some 4s and 5s and a couple 6s to top it all off. It looks like nothing I've ever seen.
27 lands, 4 Ethervile's. Perfect. Perfect every time. Okay, so that's Modern. Great. the ban seemed to just lower the Uro level, power level, to the point where all these other decks can compete. I mean, there's a Titan Vile deck out there dominating for some reason. Pioneer, we had famously a banning and then an unbanning and then a bunch of bannings. And the metagame we discussed last week had kind of settled down, and it seems like it hasn't really changed. Is that your impression as well, Damon?
Yeah, I think it's sort of solidified a little bit. I think that you'll see the Jeskai Fires deck, too good for standard, but is chugging along. I know Corey Baumeister is a big fan of it. Seems to be putting up good results consistently. But yeah, I mean, at the top, you know, Niv to Light, as we were talking about last week, still seems like one of the absolute best decks in Pioneer. Mono Green Yahtzee, they just keep rolling those Yahtzees. I gotta say, I miss Inverter a little bit. I do not miss Lotus Breach even a little bit at all. That deck can just die. But Inverter, I don't know. Even Mono White Heliod was like an interesting nemesis.
Yeah, Ballista was the best white card, weirdly, and so... We talked about this a little bit last week, but they sort of banned white as a color, unless it's supporting a blue control shell, which is unfortunate. But
Arcanist Owl was the best white card. It could get you a Walking Ballista.
That's true. It could even draw another owl.
Yeah, that owl could get you a Walking Ballista, so you, it's infinitely better.
I think last week, Doomwake went undefeated through a challenge with Mono Green Planeswalkers. I think he ran the exact same list back this week and went undefeated through a challenge or an invitational.
Yeah, it wasn't like a super qualifier or something.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was. So at this point, I think if I had to play a list for my life, I would probably play the exact 75 that Doomwake has gone undefeated against, the toughest competition in Pioneer on consecutive weeks.
I think I would take Doomwake to the Yahtzee table at Vegas's highest roller casino.
I don't think Yahtzee is a game you can play in Las Vegas, but that's maybe at the table that has Old Maid and Uno. But yeah, I would say that Mono Green, Planeswalkers, and Niv to Light are probably the two best decks in the format. And then the next tier is probably made up of like Blue White Spirits, Jeskai or Azorius in some configuration, and then Mono Black Aggro. And then I think sort of there's a bunch of other combo-ish decks that are just outside of that 1.5, which would be like a Winota, which I don't like, but I think is good against some of these other decks that don't have removal, like Mono Green Planeswalkers, for instance. And maybe like this Bolas the Citadel combo deck that people are trying to jam. And then like Sultai Delirium. That's probably like my top eight.
Dan lost to this Bolas the Citadel deck before. It was cool. telling us stories about Bolas the Citadel plus Scry 1 creatures. And then I know LSV had a video he put out where he piloted the deck. Apparently, his co-host Andrew Beckstrom on Constructed Resources was a fan of this deck and tweeting about it. LSV took a first spin. Deck looks sweet, and I guess it apparently is perhaps Pioneer's newest tier 1.5-ish deck.
Yeah, I mean, LSV went 2-3, so when, you know, Hall of Fame quality players don't do that well with a deck, you know, I'm not saying it's bad, but I'm just saying it hasn't convinced me yet. But yeah, maybe. I was a little disconcerted to see that Lotus combo is kind of still a thing. You do see it in the queues. It's still pretty good. Dig Through Time. I mean, I've been saying this for 18 months or whatever, before Pioneer is a format. Just continues to turn on these combo decks. It doesn't matter if you ban Inverter, which is why that was always a strange card to ban in the absence. But, you know, the other thing is just the format is way softer to Lotus Breach now because the deck is a little more complicated. The win isn't a total lock. It's not deterministic, so there's no reason necessarily to pack your Damping Spheres. And so you just get rolled if you don't have the right interaction.
I really think these Citadel decks should consider playing Karn the Great Creator instead of Citadel main deck. It's weird having urged everyone to give Citadel a chance all this time, that now that it's actually doing something, I'm like, you gotta take that card out and put it in your Karn Wishport. But that was my feeling when we last played the deck in Woestrider week, that it was just like much better with Mana Elves and Karn. That was capturing like the best part of the Mono Green Walkers deck, or the Yahtzee deck as Damon calls it. So some of these Citadel lists, I mean, the debate right now is, are you supposed to splash red for Mayhem Devil or not? And they're not playing that much mana acceleration. Like, some just have Gilded Goose and then the Priest of Forgotten Gods. you know, I think you should also be playing the Catacomb Citadel. You got to get to six somehow, but like, I really feel like the deck would have a more consistent plan if you had more mana elves and just like knew that as soon as you got to your four mana spot, you were, you know, potentially setting up your Citadel the next turn with a Karn. I don't think you need to be like trying to luck into it and have six mana at the same time by just drawing natural Citadels.
Yeah, so much about this deck is just so speculative. Like, the mana is absolute garbage. You're splashing red just for Mayhem Devil off of like six sources, if you want to count your Goose, which not everyone is even playing. Mayhem Devil is your only red card in your entire 75, so you have that just interact with like other elves, I guess. And then you're also playing Collected Company, so you're still just like hoping to hit. You have a bunch of terrible hits in your Collected Company. Like hitting Goose and like Blister Pod and stuff is not like what you want. Yeah, this deck is just not for me, and I look forward to continue to absolutely mop the floor with it as things go forward. This is just like Winota. It's good against maybe the good decks in the format, so people, I'm not saying people shouldn't play it, but it's bad against the kind of decks I play, and so I'm going to continue really enjoying. Oh, my Collected Company only hit a Blister Pod and a, you know, Zulaport Cutthroat. Like, yep, that's what happens. You put those into your deck, and then you cast a card that just randomly flips at your top six. There's no skill. It's just so good. I love when people get bad companies. That just lets you know that there's a god. Or they like miss with the Winota trigger. It's just like, yep, that's what your deck does.
I see it all the time when people miss on their Collected Companies and Spirits and they just get like a single Mausoleum Wanderer. But against me, they always hit this Spell Queller every single time. Spell Queller plus Droxful Captain, Droxful Captain plus Droxful Captain, you name it.
Well, in Pioneer, you hope they hit the Droxful Captain so you get the free win. But
so a question that I saw posed on Twitter. It said, which of the following scenarios is going to happen first? Uro gets banned in A, Standard, B, Historic, C, Pioneer, or D, Modern. And I was like, that's kind of an interesting poll. And then, David, you said that you don't think it should be banned at all in anything.
Well, again, I'm never speaking with any intelligence, well, maybe about anything, but I'm not even presuming to speak with intelligence about Historic or Standard. So it would not surprise me if that card was too powerful there. I don't know that. But in Pioneer and Modern, I actually think the card is great. And I think it actually is a big reason why Modern has moved towards being way more fair. It is a card that is a built-in stabilizer against Burn. And it is a card advantage engine against decks that don't try to interact. So it forces everyone else to play mid-range. And unlike other mid-range cards, which have all been like Planeswalkers for the last like 5 years, it's a creature. So all your normal creature interaction, Path to Exile kills it. I mean, it kills it in a way where they get an advantage, sure. But you can just play like normal stuff against it. As opposed to Planeswalkers, which have the snowballing effect, they really exacerbate play versus draw. This is a recurring card advantage engine that is maybe slightly too powerful. But unlike Planeswalkers, it interacts with all the normal things. It attacks, it blocks cards throughout Magic's history. Specifically say creature all the time. They don't often say Planeswalker because it wasn't a type for most of Magic's history. Although maybe now. That we're getting older, it's getting closer and closer to half of Magic's history. But yeah, this is basically what Planeswalkers do, only you have to like build your deck around it, and the counterplay is much more readily present, in my opinion. So I actually think the card is a big reason why Modern is great right now. I don't think it's broken in Pioneer. You can actually just look at all the best decks. Very few of them even play Uro. So it is a card that fetch lands make almost too powerful, and they did have to ban other cards because of it. I do think if you're a Niv-Mizzet player that's missing your mana fixing, you probably can blame Uro for a part of that. But yeah, I actually think the card is very good, and I wish Planeswalkers had never been designed. And if they wanted to create these recurring engines where it's quote-unquote always the best thing to do and you don't have to make a lot of decisions, which is kind of what Planeswalkers are, they should have just done it in a way that you have these like recurring creatures. But they didn't, and I much prefer that engine to be a creature than a Planeswalker.
I think that's a good analysis, David. I know you don't like Planeswalkers. I find them to be, you know, I don't mind them. They are a part of Magic as far as I can tell. But the thing with Uro is that it just, like, if you don't have the right tools for it, it just runs you over in such a painful way. It's not even that, like, that fast. And they gain, you know, you're like, oh man, I like almost could get lethal if I have this like sequence of top decks, because they're only at like four life, and like, I just need a bolt plus a shock or whatever. And then like all of a sudden they're at 25 life, and you're like, what just happened here? And the game is totally out of reach. And so it just can be like kind of a bit of a depressing card to play against in a way that is different than Planeswalkers. Because like if you can at least kill their Planeswalker, it doesn't come back unless Elspeth manages to conquer death on that one.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and I think there is some validity to that. If you had me design the card, I would have made it a little worse. But to compete against all the sort of Planeswalker shenanigans, etc., this is kind of how good creatures have to be. If we have to have a best fair thing, I would rather it be something like this than Ren and Six.
I'm just thinking that if David likes creatures that keep coming back by spending more mana, like wait till he hears about Commander. He's going to lose his mind. You could have the same creature. You can just keep casting it throughout the game. Amazing.
I'm not going to say anything about Commander. I respect myself too much.
I do agree, though. I don't think Uro is looking like it's so powerful it needs to be banned right now.
I mean, people are like, oh, you can't even play aggro decks because of Uro. It's like, meanwhile, Prowess just keeps showing up in every top eight. What, are they just not playing Uro decks? Or do they just have the tools to interact with it? And spending 7 mana to get a permanent 6/6 and playing a gain 6 life isn't like the end of the world.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it makes me happy as someone who has invested heavily in 4 copies of Uro. I hope to play them at least one more time, you know, in paper before they either get banned or whatever happens. I don't know what year that's going to be when we can play paper again. But yeah, you're giving me some hope.
If you make me pick, though, I would say Historic first, because that seems to be the format that it has no real like precepts about what it should be, and they respond the quickest. Standard is where they like sell all their cards, so they have obviously historically held off as long as possible on banning. So they'll probably ban it with no notice, like a week before it's about to rotate. And they, at this point, it's not even close to being ban-worthy in Modern or Pioneer.
I don't want to get into this right now, but I do just want to flag this moment, is that we might need to take a closer look at Historic in the short to medium term future. I mean, the format is getting so powerful now. It is destined to be more powerful than Pioneer. It might be, some say it already is more powerful than Pioneer. And it's going to be like the Modern / Legacy of Arena eventually. I don't know if that's going to be next year or 2 years from now. So it's an interesting card pool, I'll just say that much.
The problem is that involves installing Arena, which I just have not done yet. And then, oh my gosh, the Amaket screen with like the dust going across, it's just not how I play Magic. Like,
yeah, yeah. That's a conversation for another day. But
yeah, but yeah, to answer the poll at a fundamental level, I suspect Standard is where Uro needs to go next. I mean, it seems like a lot of the top Standard decks do all just play a bunch of Uros.
Yeah, and I mean, rotation's coming right up in a month or so. So we'll see. We are in the calm before the Zendikar dust storm or whatever's happening on Zendikar these days, which we'll be finding out soon.
Do you think Uro letting you play an extra land is going to matter in a lands matter format, or what are you positing there?
I mean, you guys just spent several examples telling me how the three life is so important. Reviving Dose is crushing the hopes of burn decks and making format fair again. Not once did you mention playing extra lands, so just saying. Maybe I was right the whole time that Reviving Dose.
Well, that's because we're not playing a Geopede right now.
All right, well, let's leave it there for now. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we will catch up on our white cards from last week.
We are back. So as people may remember, last week we didn't really have a particular white card that really tickled our fancy to be worthy of, you know, multiple deck assessment. But we just sort of did a potpourri, as Dan says, the white album. the four Beatles were feuding, and so, you know, they each went to their own studio and did acid and, you know, recorded a bunch of acoustic jams. So we had a bunch of different white cards. We proposed a bunch of different decks. We did not get to all of them, but we did get to several of them. So first up, we had a Modern Brew that I had suggested, and then Nassif had already 5-0'd with a slightly different version, and it had kind of intrigued Damon. So Damon, you took your sort of melding of those two into a league?
Yeah, I basically just took the two lists, averaged them, and set out for battle.
The Frank Karsten method?
Exactly, yeah. So by that I mean I played a total of, I believe, 8 of the kind of Soul Sisters, which includes the Honorary Sister Oriac Champion, even though Soul is not in that card's name. Actually, it's a 4 of, just because that card's good. It survives against all sorts of removal spells. And then I wound up with 2 Sarah Ascendant and then 4 of the new Hotness, Speaker of the Heavens, which was one of our white cards that we were highlighting. So this is, again, 1 and a white for a 1/1 Vigilance Lifelink Human Cleric with tap to make a 4/4 white angel token with flying, only if you have 27 or more life, and you can only activate that as a sorcery speed ability. This is all paired with a Martyr of Sands package. I threw in a couple of Johnny's Pride Mate because they love it when you gain life, and then some Heliads who love it when you gain life, and then at that point you play a bunch of Ranger Captain of Eosis to either find your one drops or a couple of Walking Ballistas for the Heliad combo potential. And then just to round things out, a couple Lurus, a couple Force of Virtue, and a bunch of Squadron Hawks. Whole squad worth. So I set up for the queues, and I immediately was paired against Mono Brown Core Tapper, looked at my sideboard, was like, all right, in come the Stony Silence, this is a lock. And then I realized that I had not sideboarded Stony Silence. I was not even thinking about that card. I was probably copying some other sideboard and just, yeah. Worth having a couple of those in your sideboard, even in this day and age, I guess.
I mean, we haven't said that phrase in a very long time. When was the last time Stony Silence was a relevant card?
Well, I think we talked about it when we talked about the Core Tapper list. I think I even said nobody's even thinking about putting Stony Silence in their sideboard, so maybe that's why the list is good. And here we find, in the wild, a real live example, a modern mono white player not even considering Stony Silence.
It's true, Dan. I mean, maybe I am just sort of, you know, hindsight biased. Oh, of course I want Stony Silence. I played against the Core Tapper deck. I do wonder, though, against, like, for example, Eldrazi Tron, now they're playing all these Maze Might Tomes. KCI is long gone. That's when it really, really helped. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe it's excusable to not have two Stony Silences.
Yeah, I mean, I see you have the full set of Damping Spheres in your sideboard, which I guess maybe you're thinking for Tron or whatever else, some weird combo decks. It used to be the case, you know, ages ago, a year and a half ago, that the biggest problem with Modern was that it was always a sideboard battle, like who draws their sideboard hate card first, and then you had to, like, really be economical about your 15 slots and try to pick cards that do double duty, so, like, maybe not all the Damping Spheres, maybe you want, you know, two of them to be Stony Silences so that they can hedge against, you know, whatever else while still being relevant against Tron or something. And I've just kind of forgotten about all the things we used to know about how to do that. Now it's just like, yeah. The format's full of problems. Let's get some Damping Spheres in there and hope for the best.
Yeah. Well, certainly Damping Sphere was a card I can believe in a mono white deck with just really no defenses against combo or big mana that just take the best card against them and play four of them in the sideboard, maybe even more. Yeah, so next up I played against Grixis Death Shadow, and it was a really, really classic style match. It was such a funny, interesting game. This deck features these Oryak champions and is trying to gain a bunch of life. Shadow's trying to reduce their life to create big Death Shadows. You can block those indefinitely with an Oryak champion or even a Speaker of the Heavens making chump token angels every turn, or a Lurus buying back a one drop every turn. But of course, they have the Colgan's commands and just a bunch of disruption. So it felt like a really balanced matchup, but I kind of cleaned the floor 2-0, including like a hilarious game two where I think I just start with a measly Speaker of the Heavens, and my opponent like plays does some stuff. They go to 10 life, and on turn three, they play three Death Shadows. And it's like, whoa, this game just got real. I was at 32 life and getting pretty excited about untapping to make a 4/4, but three Death Shadows on turn three is just, you really wish you had your Detention Spheres. But I want to prevailing just because, you could chump block. I had Oryak Champions to hold back the Shadows. I had a couple Cyborg Celestial Purges, and I won that match. Go to the next match, and opponent on the play, turn one Goblin Guide. I'm like, yes! What an easy win. And it was. I just played an Oryak champion on turn two, and they must have been really mad that this was game one. They can skullcrack all they want, but with this much life gain, it's not a good time for them. Then I played against Tron. That went about as you would expect. I drew the Damping Sphere too late. I think actually I lost 1-2. I won one game off Damping Sphere. But it's just, there's no Field of Runes in this deck. There's no Ghost Quarters. The deck has a bunch of white pips, and so you can't really squeeze those in super easily. So that is just a terrible matchup. And then in the Soul Sister's Mirror, I used my extensive four match experience with this build to convincingly defeat my opponent 2-0.
The Soul Sister's Mirror.
Yeah, it was a surprise to see that in the fifth match. So 3-2. This deck just is a classic example of how polarized the matchups are. Burn is a cakewalk. Tron is almost impossible, and just kind of maybe there's like, maybe Jund is actually kind of 50-50-ish, like just because they have some good cards against us, we have good cards against them.
How did the Speaker of the Heavens do specifically? Did a lot of 4/4 angels get made?
It's a weird card. So it compares very simply to Sarah Ascendant. Sarah Ascendant requires 3 more life, point to Speaker. Speaker of the Heavens makes 4/4 angels. This is somewhat worse in the sense that one thing that you can do with these mono white decks, if you're against an unfavorable matchup, is you just kind of hope that you go turn 1 Martyr of Sands, turn 2, or turn 1 Sarah Ascendant actually, turn 2 Martyr of Sands, sack and gain 12 life, hit you for 6, and then you actually have a pretty fast clock. I mean, that like makes Delver look like a little piece of garbage at that point. And so you can just rely on these, as they rely on, hope for these dream starts. With Speaker, it's just not as fast because you have to play the Speaker and then untap with it to make a 4/4 and then untap with a 4/4 to attack with it. And meanwhile, if you were at 35 life against a burn deck, Sarah Ascendant is 6/6. Like, the game is just going to, they have nothing against you at that point. Whereas Speaker of the Heavens is still a 1/1 and is still fragile. Obviously, they both still died a Fatal Push. So it's only like a certain class removal where that matters. My overall feeling is that Speaker of the Heavens doesn't really add anything to the deck, and I never liked playing too many Sarah Ascendants anyway. I would much rather find them as needed with Ranger Captain once you've gotten your life total warmed up. But cool card. I had fun making angels, I'll say that much.
So you're thinking the best build would play none, or maybe one, and then even would only have less than 4 Sarah Ascendant as well. So you have some slots opened up for something. Is there a better card that you wish you had?
Hard to say. I'm still kind of torn on where I would want to land on the Martyr Proc Soul Sister spectrum, with Martyr Proc featuring a little bit more of like these kind of controlling mid-range cards and Soul Sisters going more into a Johnny's Pride Mid, of which I only had 2. And there's still only room to add another Heliad to try to get, you know, access to these Heliad Ballista lines, which can happen pretty early, especially with the incidental life gain where you go, turn 1 Soul Warden, turn 3 Heliad, turn 4 1/1 Ballista, but then the Soul Warden trigger makes you get another counter on it, and then you give it lifelink and it's a turn 4 kill. And really just kind of double down on that potential. So yeah, a lot of different directions to be pulled in, and I can't say that I'm drawn to anyone in particular. But to answer your question, I think the direction all the directions involve playing far fewer copies of Speaker of the Heavens, possibly 0, and still run 1 to 2 to maybe 3 Sarah Ascendant. Or maybe you could do a 2-1 split.
Well, before we leave Modern, I decided to take one of the lists that we talked about last week through some matches. Actually, it didn't do a full league, but I took the Basri Ket deck that I had proposed that was meant to be an adaptation of Jim Davis's mono-white Loxabots aggro. Loxabots, so it's Venerated Loxodon, that's the elephant that has Convoke, and whenever it convokes, it gets to put a +1/+1 counter on all of the creatures that teamed up to summon the elephant. So you can take a bunch of, you know, the tiniest, scrappiest Memnites and Ornithopters around, just vomit them onto the battlefields, convoke out the Loxodon, and suddenly they're slightly bigger, and then maybe a couple attacks later you've dealt lethal damage. Or that was the hope, anyway. In order to make this work in the Modern that we have now, which does not have access to Mox Opal, that was a key card in kind of rewarding you for playing all these robots, and also allowing you to play things like a sufficient number of artifacts for Toolcraft Exemplar, and also having like a Ghost Quarter, Lead and Arbiter mana base like Jim Davis has. All that stuff kind of, once you remove Opal from the deck, those angles sort of fall apart. So I had to sort of reimagine it as a Mox Amber deck, which meant filling out the curve with all kinds of bad legends. Isamaru Hound of Kanda is a 3-of, Kithion Hero of Akros is a 4-of. I was still playing Thalia, Guardian of the Thraven, who's, you know, actually good. 4 of her, 1 of Anafenza Kintry Spirit. And I went up to 3 Basri Kets just because I wanted to see what would happen if I drew them. Basri Ket has 3 loyalty abilities, but only one of them actually does anything. That's the -2. So the +1 will put a counter on something, make it indestructible for the turn, and that's it. The -2 will give you kind of a raise the alarm with haste. It says whenever you attack this turn, for each non-token creature that is attacking, you get to put a 1/1 human soldier into play, tapped and attacking. So that was what I was looking for, the ability to just get a bunch of little guys into play, real cards, not tokens. Then on the turn in which I have 3 mana, I would potentially play a Basri Ket, minus two and then attack for, I don't know how much. If I had a signal pest in play, I can stack them so that I get my tokens first, then they all receive the signal pest boost and kind of get 2-1 attackers that way. So that was a deck, and I basically didn't think it was worthy of actually playing in a league because it just looked really, really kind of skeevy and just cobbled together. So I took it to the tournament practice rooms just to test for basic functionality and to see like what the hands looked like. And oof, this deck was not good. This deck was real, real bad. I won my first match against Jund. I got a cool screenshot of Basri minus twoing to get like 5 tokens all getting buffed by a signal pest to win the match. And I thought I should probably just quit while I'm ahead, but the deck just felt horrendous. I played one more match just to check, and it was as bad as I thought it would be. I got destroyed in my second match and just called it quits there.
Yeah, I mean, I think we kind of identified when you were proposing this list. This is one that, you know, you could imagine maybe doing well in a league if you're always on the play, you know, like some of those zoo lists. And you do have those really polarized draws where when you draw, you know, exactly one legend and one Mox Amber and the right number of lands, it kind of does everything you want. And then if anything is off, then it, the fact that these cards are individually not very powerful begins to really show its ugly head.
Yeah. I mean, I was amazed to see just like how many fail states there were just in your opening hands, right? You have, you know, it's an 18 land for Mox Amber deck. So you could have not enough lands. You could have too many duplicate legends. There's so many legends in here. You could have a Venerated Loxodon without enough small creatures to actually convoke it. You could have too many small creatures and not have a Loxodon to pay you off for having them. And then you just have all these Ornithopters and Midnights, which is useless. You could have a Mox Amber, but no legend to enable the Mox Amber. And it's just like, man, like just drawing 7 and like most of your opening 7s don't do anything was really depressing. So I don't think this deck is it. I think that the whole like white weenie amber strategy is not quite there. If it ever was, it has a ways to go still. Second thing that was discouraging was just that Basri himself was really disappointing. The +1, I had to activate it several times, even like accelerated into a turn 2 Basri in one game off of an amber. And all you really get to do then is +1 to grow your Isamaru a couple times. And that's it. And then it got fatal pushed. And then I just had a Basri that didn't do anything. So I'm off this card. I'm off this deck. Nothing more to say about it.
On the plus side, you passed the Hero of Bladeholds trigger stacking test with your Signal Pest Basri Ket line.
Yeah.
When I'm playing live, I just say I sack them such that they get the trigger. But on Magic Online, you have to make that manifest with your correct ordering.
First in, first out. Wait, no, that's a cue.
Not what Damon said. Don't do what Damon said. Do what Damon said.
First in, last out. That's a stack. I was describing a cue. These are data structures that come up in computer science. And Magic implements a stack, which is first in, last out. F-I-L-O.
All right, so much for Basri, so much for Modern. Dave, what were you playing?
So, yeah, I proposed this 9 lives combo list, which also took advantage of Demonic Pact, which is a card I love. And Dan normally doesn't let me play, so he was forced to. We were so bereft of white cards, I got to propose this. I think Damon was like, you know, you should really play this in the practice room first. This is going to be, you know, this is going to be tough. And then I just went out and I went 3-2 in the league. And I, each of the 2 matches I lost was only because like 6 or 7 draws in a row had to be the wrong card for me to lose the third game in each of those matches. So the combo I was trying to take advantage of was 9 lives and Solemnity together prevents you from taking any more damage. And against a lot of the aggro decks in the format, so we're talking about Winota, Mono Black, Mono Red, Red White, White Black, etc. They have no main deck way to answer that. Spirits as well. They don't play Brazen Borrower for whatever reason. And then in addition to that, I kind of had 2 other little combos built in, which was the Demonic Pact Harmless Offering combo. I think we're all familiar with that by now. And then Harmless Offering can also give your opponent a 9 lives. And then I was playing Farika's Libation, which can cause a player to sacrifice an enchantment. So you have this kind of like backdoor way to win. Or if you just use up a 9 lives, if it already has 8 counters on it, you can just give it to your opponent play a fresh nine lives if you like. That never actually came up, but so it was kind of a question of, is this going to actually be feasible against aggro decks? And it was. I played three aggro decks, and in at least one of the two games I won against them, I did set up a Solemnity Lock, and they were super salty about it in the chat. Like, what the hell is going on? They kept attacking me and nothing was happening, and so they had to like read all the cards in play. And then against the sort of more controlling deck, so I played Salty Delirium, stock Salty Delirium, and stock Jeskai Urian Luka. You kind of side out of that package because it doesn't really do anything against them. And you kind of have this like transformational board where you're just playing all these control kill cards and you're trying to set up a Demonic Pact win, or just a Demonic Pact like snowball effect where they maybe even have to kill it out, which they did multiple times out of fear that I had the combo. But after it's already drawn me two cards or something, so they were getting rid of it for me.
I'm really surprised and impressed that you did so well with this.
Yeah, I was shocked to see the 3-2. And the screenshots you sent looked awesome. I will say that I'm not surprised your opponents had to read the cards carefully. I was playing this similar Solemnity combo deck in Canlander. And I was like, well, what happens if I play my Birth of Meletus? Because it says enchantments can't get counters. I was like, well, do I get anything out of it? And the answer is no, you don't get anything out of your saga.
And to your point, Damon, I actually think I was boarding out all my Solemnities against Jeskai Luka, but I think I should have left them in. Like, the only way they had to interact with my Demonic Pact was Elspeth Conquers Death. So I think I should have had it as just sort of a, I don't know what you want, almost like a Meddling Mage type effect that I just preemptively play. And without being able to kill my Demonic Pact, they could not beat me.
Yeah, it's like Stony Silence for Sagas.
Yeah, there you go. And, you know, it affects like seven cards in their deck, maybe. Maybe just leaving it as a one of was something I should have done. But yeah, like there was one instance, all I needed was a red card over the course of a red land over the course of six draws before they took my one red land. And then the turn I had another draw on my turn and then another two draws with Sign and Blood. So I had like eight or nine draws to hit a red land to give them my Demonic Pact. And it didn't happen. So I did. The list that we're going to post has a slightly tweaked mana base, which I think is better. A couple more Triomes. And then it trims some of the win conditions, but plays more Dark Petition and Nahiri to sort of like discard the cards you don't need in the various polarizing matchups. And Dark Petition is like sort of a functional version of Solemnity or Harmless Offering or whatever half of the combo you're missing. The one thing that's very difficult is deciding like to keep hands. Like if you have a Thoughtseize and a Sign and Blood in your hand and some lands and you don't have much to do, if you're playing a control deck, that's actually a great hand. If you're playing an aggro deck, it's a terrible hand, right? You're going to Thoughtseize a burn spell and do two to yourself and then do two more to yourself and draw two cards. So it actually was quite helpful to play against a deck that like revealed Lurrus or revealed Urian in game one, because it actually gave you a lot of information about what kind of hands you should be mulliganing towards.
Yeah, I think one thing that Dan and I were both expecting that we're surprised to see, but makes sense in hindsight, is that this deck doesn't have that bad of a control matchup as we would have thought. And on further thinking, it's like, well, actually, you're playing a bunch of haymakers. Like, control decks really don't want you to resolve a Demonic Pact, like banking off the fact that they can counter your Harmless Offering a few turns later, because you go up so many resources as you go through the turns on that card, and all you need to do is come up with enough Thoughtseizes plus making them discard two cards that they may wind up being shields down when it comes to your final offering. Meanwhile, you have like some Planeswalkers, some Card Advantage, and the Sign and Bloods, and just a bunch of kind of Mardu grindy cards. And meanwhile, in game one, you have Fatal Pushes that are bad. They have all sorts of anti-creature cards that are bad. Whereas if anything, you have kind of this leaner Solemnity Nine Lives combo to escape aggro, whereas controllers have to run a whole host of Verdicts and Azorius Charms and all sorts of just random stuff.
Yeah, I echo Damon's surprise. Like I said last week, I don't think this deck can keep up with a dedicated control deck with just this random pile of Mardu removal and Planeswalkers, but I mean, you did it for the most part. You even had an Obnixilus Reignited sighting. There were two in your sideboard, and I saw him hustling some people in your screenshot reports.
Yeah, and I'm actually bringing those in like over Sign and Bloods. I mean, it's a fine card against control. It was awesome against Delirium, but it's also just like a little better than your worst cards against aggro, because it kind of becomes your like one card advantage engine. It's also like you just kind of want to go removal, removal, removal. If your last removal spell is on Nyxalis, then on your next turn, it, you know, just turns into an arena or a Phyrexian arena and, you know, alternates between doing that and killing. But yeah, the card was sweet, and your like anti-control package, and I even tweaked out my board a little bit to even be better, You know, you get to bring in a bunch of dresses. You get to bring in Painful Truths. You have all these Planeswalkers. And then you have like Dread Boars, which is a reasonable card against aggro. It's a reasonable card against all these Planeswalker control decks. So
Obnixilus is funny because the card is just so much worse than Teferi, Hero of Dominaria. But somehow is still playable, which just speaks to how good Teferi is.
Yeah, when I was like, what is my like big... Okay, I thought sees them on turn four and, you know, they don't have that. You know, I took their one counter spell and I want to resolve something on five. Like, what is it going to be? There actually isn't that much. I, you know, like six mana Liliana. I mean, I didn't know what I wanted really. So yeah, this was what I settled on. There didn't seem to be better anti-control Planeswalker.
Yeah, Nahiri is pretty good, except you have no creatures.
Right.
She just runs
into tutor. Yeah.
We'll see with the Dark Petitions though. Like, I've never seen such a fair looking use of this card. Like, what are you normally tutoring for?
It's basically like an out, so you don't need to have Harmless Offerings like 3 and 4 and Solemnity 3 and 4. So a lot of times you're just finding like the combo piece. You have 4-9 lives. The other thing you can do is like find your sweepers if you need it. It's also, I'm only playing 3 demonic packs. So a lot of times you just need a demonic pack to like start the process of ending the game. So it's a way to find that. The bottom half of your deck is all instants and sorcery. So it almost always is generating 3 black mana for you. So hopefully, you know, you're not taking the complete turn off just a tutor. You're able to cast it and do something on that turn.
And then with 9 lives in particular, is this a card that you can play against aggro and be like, I successfully stabilized for a few more turns? Or do you have to have like a line of sight to Solemnity like in mind?
Yeah, so that actually was a really interesting question. So I'd be at like 12 and I'd be like, all right, are they going to be able to kill me next turn? Because I want to take as much damage as possible before I play this. So I was like having to make some calculated decisions. The thing that's crazy is against some of these like Bone Crusher Giant, it just adds a counter a turn. So they don't have like a lot of sources, a lot of these people. So yeah, it actually was a card I waited and waited and waited. I tried to get down to like 5 or 6 life before I played it. And then it almost gives you another like 20 life because each instance of damage just adds one counter. So they cast Wizard Lightning on you. That's just one counter. They attack you with Bone Crusher Giant. That's one counter. They hit you with a giant Sprite Dragon. That's one counter. And so you actually have a lot of time, whether it's killing their creatures or finding the Solemnity to stop them or giving them the used up 9 lives. You actually have a lot of time to find that.
I just realized, yeah, so 9 lives laughs off Bone Crusher Giant, but actually you're probably terrified of Stomp.
Yes, that is a good point.
Weird. Or Questing Beast for that matter.
Yeah, that never came up.
Yeah, Bone Crusher Giant is, I mean, it's a heck of a card, and somehow we always forget. It has all this extra text, you know? It's a shock plus a 4/3, but it has all this extra text on it. I even got by it just today in by my own Bone Crusher Giant. I stomped, and it did not do what I thought it was going to do.
Yeah, we'll have to get to that in a second. So I guess my takeaway on this list is I'm posting my updated list, and I'll probably run it at some point in the future through a league again. It actually felt really good. You're very competitive. I mean, I think Delirium and Jeskai Uriah and Luka in the 2-0 bracket, you know, that's just a reasonable, like, high-powered deck that you'd expect to be playing, and I did not feel, like, overpowered or like I had no chance. In fact, they literally top-decked. This is funny. They top-decked Emrakul. On my board, I had a Obnixilus at 6. That was it. They top-deck Emrakul. They take my turn. I have no hand. So I was like, all right, well, there's a bunch of dead draws here. They drew Harmless Offering and then gave themselves the Obnixilus. And then, of course, on my next turn, I drew a Dreadboar. So had they just drawn a land that turn, I would have just killed their Emrakul and started to win the game with my Obnixilus. But not to be. So, I mean, they get to draw well as two, but...
Yeah, Emrakul with Demonic Pact in your deck is just a terrifying sight because there's that little, you can choose to lose the game.
Yeah, so I was having to decide even in games where I was a little bit ahead, but a resolved Demonic Pact would like put me way ahead. Like, do I want to do this? And I actually waited until I had a rest in peace so they didn't have access to Emrakul.
Yeah, I'm just encouraged that you had so much play against these decks that are designed to go longer. And I'm suspecting that it's because you had a lot of black cards in your deck, so you had good options for that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, like, you know, quote-unquote meme-ish cards on 3 and 4, but, I mean, fundamentally, you're a Thoughtseize push deck, so your floor is actually pretty high. I mean, those are very, very powerful cards. They give you a chance in a bunch of matchups. Because your deck is so well-suited against a lot of these aggro decks, you can kind of push a large amount of your sideboard to being able to fight, you know, the specific matchups you think you're going to be weak in.
Yeah, and I mean, Dreadboring a Teferi, like, kills it, even though you go down a card.
Yep. So, Dan, you took an equally speculative list into the Pioneer queues, which made use or not of the Bone Crusher Giant. So tell us about what you played.
Yeah, I played the Stormwild Capper list, Chonky Capper, as David called it. So this is David's list that he talked about last week. It's actually mostly a red deck. Chonky in that it has similar curve, similar cards as the Chonky Red, Big Red style deck that topped out on Glorybringer. But it fills out the curve with cards that synergize with dealing damage to your own creatures. Both Stormwild Capitor and Boros Reckoner will give you a bonus when you successfully deal damage to your own creature. Marauding Raptor is a card that David identified as just like the perfect enabler for these. So the Marauding Raptor will make your Stormwild Capitor one cheaper, will punch it for two damage and sort of kickstart its journey into being the bird goat, the goat. You'll get a 3/5 Capitor that way. And then if you want to, you can keep growing it. You have Reckless Rages to deal more damage to the Capitor. You can Chandra Torch of Defiance to -3 to deal 4 more damage to it to get it even bigger, which I did a couple of times. And if you really want to get fancy, you can go all the way up to Star of Extinction for the combo finish. That's 20 damage to everything. The Capitor will just absorb that damage and get 20 counters on it. Ditto for the Boros Reckoner. It will die, but it will shoot them for 20. So that's the basic core of the deck. There's some Glorybringers. There's a couple Chained to the Rocks. And for Bonecrusher Giant, it's just a good all-purpose card. I was thinking, hey, you can get a little extra use stomping your Capitor to pump it up +2/+2 instead of just having to stomp their face. Or so I thought. So I immediately joined the queues, got paired against the blue-black control, and I was like, well, this is not going well, but at least I can stomp my Capitor. Turns out that if you do that, the damage is not prevented, because stomp does not allow damage to be prevented. So my Capitor just took 2 damage, and you only get the counters equal to the amount of damage that was prevented, which was 0 in this case. So I just like wasted a stomp, and then I got my opponent down to 2 life, and then they killed me. So if I just stomped their face, I would have won the game. But instead, I tried to stomp the Capitor and just threw it all away. So started off strong in the 0-1 bracket against what turned out to be a Narset Undoing deck. Beat 5 color Niv somehow, got a couple matchups against mono green planeswalkers. I won both of those. They were pretty impressive. That was a matchup where everything this deck was trying to do actually got to really show off a little bit, because that deck is full of small creatures. It cares about planeswalkers, it cares about combat, and it cares about the size of your creatures. You know, they're trying to fight with voracious hydras or whatnot. Just that stuff is not going to work against the Capitor Reckoner strategy. And my red damage spells were great. Even my Star of Extinctions were great. So yeah, I was pretty encouraged. I was 3-1 at that point, but I kind of suspected that the control matchup was quite bad. Sure enough, in round 5, got paired against just straight blue-white control, and I was just wiped off the map. I didn't even come close to presenting any kind of threat. None of my creatures mattered, and none of my answers mattered. So I feel like this deck, you know, despite going 3-2, didn't feel like I had a good matchup spread. I was hoping to get paired against more aggro decks, but I don't think this has much of anything against control. And when I was trying to figure out what to put in the sideboard, when you're limited to just red and white, there isn't a whole lot. You know, I had one of the biggest Chandra Awakened Inferno. I probably should have played 2. But beyond that, I can't even think of a card that would turn a matchup around after, you know, they've been 1-1 in you the whole time and then casting multiple dig through times. Do you guys have any solutions to the control problem?
Maze Mind Tome.
Yeah. I mean, I considered it. I put Treasure Maps in instead. The original Maze Mind Tome, just because I figured I would also be bringing in Star of Extinction number 4, and I wanted to have another way to kind of get to 7 in a surprise sequence. But the way it played out, the treasure maps could have just been Maze Mind Tomes. Maybe they should have been. But even that wouldn't have been enough. I was so far behind against both the blue-black and the blue-white decks.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, there aren't a lot of options. Normally you say planeswalkers, but there aren't good planeswalkers in those colors that line up that well with control. You're just saying even the Mardu colors, I had a hard time finding a planeswalker that really lined up well against what other planeswalkers are doing. And I don't think red and white is good at killing planeswalkers either. So normally red's answer to planeswalkers is to try to go under them, but we're sort of built in such a big mid-range style. I don't think it's really possible to do.
Yeah. Big Chandra though. I mean, that card can go a long way. And you're already playing, you know, four Chandra Torch of Defiance, which is at least a pretty good card against blue-white control, even if they have counter spells and cards that answer it.
Yeah, I mean, you can put in big Chandra as just like a prayer and hope that you draw it and that it somehow wins, you know, before it's too late. But you're talking about a red-white deck that is not seeing any extra cards. It's just drawing one card a turn. And like meanwhile, like you look at their library and they've gone like 15 cards deeper into their deck by the same point in the game. Where you're like, I hope I draw my one of that I in the sideboard that will somehow turn it all around. You just can't do it. I mean, like none of your creatures matter. You're drawing these Capriters and it's like, man, this is a 1/3. And like the stuff that would pump it up, either Marauding Raptors can pump it a little bit to just play into Supreme Verdict even further. The Reckless Rages have no targets, so they're no good. So yeah, that was just a little bit hopeless. So I think that this deck, while cool and fancy, just has like too big of a matchup problem against like what I think of as a metagame right now. As you know, a lot of people like to play control, and I'm not surprised to face two control decks and a Niv deck in 5 rounds.
On the other hand, you beat the Niv deck, you beat Mono Green Walkers, and the aggro matchups all seem like pretty good for you. So actually, like, this matchup spread sounds fine. Like, if you have a good Spirits matchup, good Mono Green Walkers matchup, a survivable Niv matchup, a good Mono Black matchup, good Mono Red matchup, and a terrible Blue-White matchup, that is a deck that you can take into a challenge.
Why don't you take the deck into the challenge? I'm going to take something else into the challenge. We'll just compare notes afterwards, see how that went. I do not think this deck has a good Niv matchup, for the record.
It would be interesting to see like how much you could bend the sideboard and see if that is salvageable. I'm guessing it's not. I just can't even think of what the cards would be. I don't even know what's like. I mean, the problem is planeswalkers are just like generically super powerful. So if you don't have like an easy way to kill them, then I don't really know what.
Looking at the sideboard, I mean, like you probably just don't need these, like some of these cards against like creature decks, like the Chain to the Rocks, the Deafening Clarions, the Magma Spray. Just play more Chandras. Play some Gideons.
I know you said you did not like the Raptor Hatchlings in the main deck, Dan. You don't even think you need them against aggro just because your deck's like well-suited against it?
I mean, it's not that well-suited against aggro. It's a pretty slow deck. Reckless Rage is not active until turn 3 at the earliest. So, I mean, I'm not really sure like how you can fix that. Like, I understand why the Raptors are there, because if you're paired against aggro, you need something on turn 2, and Reckless Rage is not live yet, so you just need something. But like, it's just it's a card that's basically blank in the slower matchups.
Mm.
And I mean, Damon, I hear what you're saying. I can just like ignore the plan of my deck and just become just a random pile of planeswalkers. But at that point, like, why are we doing it?
Well, because the main deck configuration with this synergy-based Capridor plan is good against a lot of the decks, and that's why you have, it seems like, a number of good matchups.
Well, we don't know that. I mean, we don't know that for sure. I did not get paired against any aggro decks, so.
Boros Reckoner is really good against Mono Red, I'll tell you that much. Normal Capridor is really good against Mono Red. Mono Black, in theory, they can maybe get underneath, they can push your Boros Reckoner. I still feel like you'd have at least a decent Mono Black matchup. But I definitely agree. This deck is still rough around the edges, very experimental. We learn a lot from your experience, and there's still a lot to learn about this. But this looks promising to me.
Well, lots of things to tweak. Obviously, when you start out with a synergy that no one's considering, you could even go like full-on combo like some of these mono-red Minotaur decks do, where they have got a bunch of ways to cast an early Star of Extinction. So you could reduce the quality of some other cards just to be able to do that. That might be worth doing. Like you could cut the 3 Raptor Hatchlings and play the like 4 mana, your make 7 mana, you can only cast one more spell this turn. So you'd have a bunch of lines into turn 4 or 5 kills with your Capridor or Reckoner, for instance.
Yeah, Iron Craig Feet, absolutely.
Yeah.
If you want to kind of turbo the combo out. I was considering the card Sundering Stroke, which is from the same set as Iron Critic Feat. It's from Throne of Eldraine. It's a 7-mana sorcery, and it says if you spent 7 red on the stroke, you get to deal, like, 7 damage to up to 3 targets. Which, you know, whatever, 7 is not 20, so what's the big deal? Except that in this deck, it kind of is 20, if you have the Capiter in play. I was like, maybe. Like, if you want to lean hard on the Aaron Craig Feet build, you have, like, another 7 drop that you could consider. I don't know, just a thought. The reason that I didn't go for the Aaron Craig Feats was just because, like, if you don't have Star of Extinction, you know, you're not talking about a 3-card combo where you don't have any way to search for.
Yeah.
And, like, what I really want out of the deck is some, like, better utility land, like a land that... I basically want Castle Vantress. This deck spends a lot of time just, like, sitting around doing nothing. So possibly you could even just, like, splash another color or something and play more card draw and get a Castle Vantress in there that way. But, yeah, stuff to tool around with. So we'll leave it at that for these particular decks. One thing that we did not really have time to address in full detail last week was the sort of more theoretical question. You know, we're saying that white as a color has struggled. A lot of these white cards seem pretty narrow and bad. But, like, why is that the statement generally true that white is bad or white is struggling? Is it just that, you know, the cards printed lately have not been good? Or is there something more fundamental going on here with white's position in the metagame? Or its slice of the color pie, or just, like, where it fits into Magic's in 2020. What do you guys think about that?
I've heard an argument that just says that white's part of the color pie doesn't really make sense anymore. The way it used to be about, like, small creatures and tax effects and balance effects and Armageddon. And this is sort of, like, slowly shifted where now all of a sudden every color gets access to good card draw except for white. So red has these, like, Chandras that draw you cards. It has cards like Light Up the Stage. Green has Uro and Tireless Tracker in various formats and other kind of effective card draw cards. The green Planeswalkers just seem to trump the white ones. You know, Gideon, Ally of Zendikar, was a powerful card once upon a time. Compare that card to what Nissa does to Standard now, and it's like, you know, Nissa's a really good card. And Nissa sees play in Pioneer. And so, like, what white is supposed to be doing? I've heard that an interesting argument is a mana leak should be moved into white and printed into Pioneer or Standard. And that's an interesting one, that's like a new sort of taxing effect that gives white this better identity.
Yeah, I think one of the problems is one of the things that white does, almost all of them other than these white weenie creatures, is super defensive. So it means you're not proactively trying to win the game with these white cards. Wrath of God is an archetypal white spell, right? Sweeping. So they continue to print reasonably powered cards. They printed a 4-mana sweeper in Standard with a drawback, right? You get to draw a card if you have a creature with 4 power or more. Not always a drawback. Playing Gideon or whatever, some kind of nonsense. But okay, so you just get a different sweeper every couple of new sets. They print a variant of it. But the things that you do to actually win games are in modern Magic are you pay 3, 4, 5 mana for a Planeswalker, or you pay 3 or 4 mana for a creature with a coming to play ability. And most of what white does is just good at removing things. The other best white card they printed is Elspeth Conqueror's Death. That's just a really fancy removal spell, and it pairs well with other colors. It's not how you win the game. So these, like, major threats that in these sort of mid-range dreadnought battles that are what they want modern Magic to be, white doesn't line up with those things because green is supposed to have bigger creatures and red is supposed to have creatures with haste, you know, and black has better spot removal. So white is really consigned to be the support color for blue a lot of the time. And its other main mechanic, which is, like, gaining life, is historically the weakest effect in the history of the game. When you look at the original cycle of Ancestral Recall, Giant Growth, etc., they were trying to figure out how much one white mana would have to gain to be equivalent to Ancestral Recall. And I think Morrow was positing, like, 500 life or something. It's either, like, 150, 250, or 500. So that tells you how, like, weak life gain is. I mean, you can print life gain as an ancillary function on other cards, like on Uro, but it has to do something else. It can't just gain life. That's not a thing. And even when we kind of kicked around, oh, these three life gains for Griffin's area, it's just like, you're not winning the game, though. You're just doing nothing. So permanents are super powerful. White's strength has never been permanents. Almost all the things we listed are removing permanents from the game. And so when permanents come into play and do a thing, being good at removing them is only going to make you good enough to be a support color. The best white card draw spell is Straven Inspector, for whatever that's worth.
Yeah. White has no good endgame threats. It has no way, good way to ramp to endgame threats. In Legacy, there's Death and Taxes, which is a mono white deck that's been around for a very long time. That succeeds off the back of Wasteland and Aether Vial Thalia starts. These are not available in Pioneer or Modern. There's variants of that in Modern that's successful based off of the power levels of Giver of Runes and Stoneforge Mystic and Path to Exile. In Pioneer, you don't have any of those cards, so you play white for Seal Away. Well, black has Fatal Push. You would play white for one drops. Name a white one drop that's better than Knight of the Ebon Legion.
Yeah, I'm thinking about that card draw thing. It's interesting. So white cards that I do respect in Modern. Stoneforge Mystic, Allurist of the Dream Den, Urien, Ranger Captain of Eos. I even like Squadron Hawk. All those cards draw cards, right? Which is not white's purview, right? White is not supposed to do that. But whenever they find ways to like let white get you more resources, they tend to like work out and be like relevant cards for Constructed.
Well, two of those cards you mentioned were extremely broken and Constructed and were only considered as white cards due to the fact that they somehow have hybrid mana is their casting cost in the form of Urien and Lurrus.
Right. I mean, sure. I guess like a name SRAM as well, Core Spirit Dancer. Like when white can like keep resources going, it can actually do something. But I mean, you know, we've seen those cards, they've each sort of played out in their one archetype. But when it's not doing that, I mean, the other things that white has in its share of the color pie are just not relevant. You know, I think everything you said about life gain is quite depressing and true. You've heard that like white has the most efficient small creatures, or white has more flying than other colors. Like this matters in sealed deck and draft. You know, in Constructed, we're only drawing from the top 1% of cards, right? So, you know, if white has, you know, the best, on average, the best small creatures, but like every color has some good small creatures, you won't notice that white's small creatures are better in Constructed. You know, white's creatures are not better than Soulscar Mage and Monastery's Whisperer.
This is something that Zvi Malchowitz noticed like way back when he was designing cards, and he was like, he went to the wall. He threatened to quit because he did not think they should print Damnation. And his entire reason was, white is bad. It's been papered over how bad it is for so long because it has Wrath of God and Armageddon. And if you let other colors do this, then there's no reason to ever really need white again. And he was like hauntingly prescient. Like he understood in a way that 12 years of designers didn't. And so the only time white has been good is when Gideon was a card and there weren't efficient ways to answer it. And that card was a hilarious card because in the mirror, the play draw difference was so wild. But yeah, even like cheap efficient creatures, it's not actually that good at doing that. I mean, I don't even know what card they're specifically talking about. They print these slightly better Savannah Lions. I mean, that's just not going to get it done anymore. So the power they've given like 3-mana cards is insane. And the 1-mana cards, I mean, are still like 1/1s or 2/1s or whatever. But it's like Uro and, well, all the blue-green cards for 3-mana, you know, basically do what, like, 6-mana cards used to do. But 1-mana cards now are a little worse than Goblin Guide. And so printing a slightly better White Knight or whatever is just hilarious that that's your answer to metagames where you have Uro and, you know, et cetera. Even White's Adventure Creature, I mean, it's like the one that didn't hardly saw any play.
Yeah. It's funny because I have in paper both a Blue Moon Canlander deck and a kind of white-blue aggro, slowly morph towards mid-range deck, heavily slanted towards white, and so it just kind of splashes blue. And every set comes out, I'm like, oh man, look at all these goodies for Blue Moon I can add from these new sets that are these like cards that clearly slot in. Like imagine when I got Brazen Borrower, Bone Crusher Giant, Gadwick the Wizened, Castle Vantress, all out of Eldraine. And I was like, man, this deck just got, you know, substantially better. And meanwhile, the white base deck, just every new set, I look through the spoiler and be like, oh, okay, well, no new purchases here. That's cool.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if it's like, apart from the color pie thing, It's that for whatever reason, lately they have just not been generous with White's cards. Like when they're deciding, tweaking the knobs, as Paul Sheehan would say, to figure out how much you get for your mana. For some reason, they're not giving you very generous White cards that are like a little bit undercosted or that give you like a little more than it should. You know, there's no Uro in White. There's not even a White Titan, right? There's red, black, blue, and green get Titans. White doesn't get a Titan. And again, like, you know, I'm not saying that all White cards have to be good, but like the top 1% of White cards are like just like a little bit disappointing compared to the top 1% of all the other colors, which is what we play with and constructed.
And when the best color, best card in a color is a removal, that's not like, it's an incentive to splash for that color, but it's not intended to build around it. So Elspeth Conqueror's Death is the best white card they've printed in quite a while, I think. And it is quite good in Standard. And even in Pioneer, it sees some play. I don't think it sees any modern play. But, you know, it's hard to get excited about a color where your cat, you know, you hope to get to five mana to kill what they did. you know, part of Magic is also like winning the game. And so White's ability to do that is just really, really, really weak.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm not even that excited when people talk about, you know, great removal you could give to White. Like, I don't want that. I don't want removal. You fall behind whenever you remove a Planeswalker. So, like, I'm not looking for, like, better ways to kill Planeswalkers and fall behind. So, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but Wizards has said that they are working on it. I did pose this question on our Twitter feed at FaithlessMTG, and we got some interesting responses there. I also posed a question to our friends at the Arena Decklist podcast, Jerry Thompson and Brian Gottlieb, and they were kind enough to answer it on air in their last week's episode, actually. It was their question of the week. They both gave very eloquent responses, touching on a lot of things that we were just discussing, about how, yeah, like, the effects that White is known for, Wizards has deemed them unfun or whatever, or they're just like, they're not getting good cards in those colors, they're not relevant anymore. So give that a listen if you want another take on this question, and you know, hopefully we'll see something more exciting out of White in the future.
I think once they bend the fire design principles, it basically can't fail. So I expect a smooth transition into White just becoming another super powerful color.
The colors all have strengths and weaknesses, and we're happy with how they are relative to each other.
Yeah, wow. All right, well, let's leave it there for the White episode, the White album. We will take a break. When we come back, we will have a little more M21 potpourri with some new decks. Stay with us.
Welcome back. Our cards for the week are going to be a potpourri of some of the last cards from M21 that we've wanted to try building decks around and haven't had a chance to yet. And now that we're done with all the white shaft, put that back in your trade binders or trash can or wherever it belongs. We're onto some spicy cards like Discontinuity, See the Truth, and Transmogrify. So first up, we have Transmogrify. And so as a quick reminder of what this card does, it's basically like Polymorph, but in red, it's 3 to red for a sorcery, exile target creature, and the creature's controller flips cards on top of their library until they hit a creature. That card goes into play, and they shuffle the rest back in. And so Polymorph is famous for example, you target your creature token generated from any number of means, and you hit an Emrakul the Eon's Torn. And with the Teferi and Time Raveler in Modern, you can do this at instant speed. And so this deck kind of saw some brief popularity. I think Aspiring Spike was trying different lists. I saw Caleb Durward trying some different lists. I forget who was leading the charge on that one. But today we have David leading the charge on Transmogrify and Pioneer. So what do you have?
So Transmogrify is interesting because it kind of gives you more effects of the Luka Coppercoat ability. So people are familiar with the Jeskai Fires list. I actually don't like it. I just don't like Fires in general as a card. I feel like you really are weak against every other control deck. And you're just stuck on hitting your lands. The deck just plays out at sorcery speed. I don't like any of that. Like, you play Teferi, but you can never cast instants with this plus. So this is a list which is trying to take advantage of Inspiring Statuary. So Inspiring Statuary is a 3-mana artifact, and it gives all of your non-artifact spells, they can be cast by tapping each artifact you have for a mana. One thing this does is lets you go artifact on 1, artifact on 2, Inspiring Statuary on 3, and then you can just hard cast an Agent of Treachery that you have drawn on 4. This extra mana is also quite useful with Urion. So this is a Urion list, just like many other Urion Agent of Treachery lists. You have all this extra mana at your disposal. And one of the things that you often see with Inspiring Statuary is Karn, Scion of Urza. Well, Karn, Scion of Urza makes tokens. So you kind of have all these like cross synergies where you have these artifacts that help you like have all this mana. Teferi Time Raveler is a card, just like Damon said, in the same way that it is used to like instant speed to protect your combo and also do it at their EOT. It does the same thing with Transmogrify, or it protects a creature from removal when you're using Luka. Narset is great in these decks because she hits everything in the deck other than lands. So they're just all hits. And I guess Agent of Treachery is not a hit, but you take my point. And then another card I always have like a soft spot for that I snuck in here as a one of, because there's 80 cards, how bad could it be, is Tezzeret Artifice Master. It both makes tokens, so it pluses to make a 1-1 Thopter, which is an artifact. And with all these artifacts, it's actually, it's zero, draws two cards, which is quite powerful. So this is kind of like a little more synergy-based deck. You can actually play main deck counterspells as opposed to the other one, which is really just locked into doing like plan one. And if it gets disrupted in any way, it basically can't do anything at all. I do think Inspiring Statuary is a slightly weaker mana engine than Fighters, but I think it allows you... It raises up your fail case, but your best case scenario is worse, or if I'm saying that correctly. Like being able to cast a turn... No, your best case scenario is better. Being able to just cast a turn 4 Agent of Treachery against a Fires deck, which can't interact with that play at all, is basically game over. And it's a line that they can never execute.
Well, wasn't it some weeks ago where we were talking about how Agent of Treachery wasn't even like that good at anymore? So what's changed in your eyes to that this is a card you want to see play now?
Well, if I'm playing against decks that have Planeswalkers, then I'm very interested in Agent of Treachery because it's often taking 4 or 5 of their mana and I'm immediately getting a card or a card-like ability from it. So if we're talking about the best decks in the format being, in some order, mono green Planeswalkers and Niv-Mizzet, which is basically Niv-Mizzet and a pile of Planeswalkers, Agent of Treachery is often taking a 6-6 Dragon. Or Uro, or Teferi himself, or one of the other Planeswalkers that might be getting played. Also, the mono green list obviously is just all Planeswalkers, so there's lots of juicy targets there. Specifically, taking their Karn is probably key because it shuts down huge parts of this deck.
Yeah, I can buy that. I mean, to be fair, you were using Agent of Treachery before the bannings, and that was just a very different Pioneer format.
This deck goes in so many unexpected directions. I'm not quite sure what to make of it. So Inspiring Statuary, I think the easiest way to think of it is that it is like 1/3 of Urza Lord High Artificer. You know, Urza lets you tap your artifacts for a blue, and Inspiring Statuary kind of lets you do that. Except that it's worse than that. And then it also doesn't make a construct, and it doesn't also draw cards for 5 mana each time. So it's really a very, very limited card in terms of what it can do. So in that sense, like, I'm not sure I want to go that far out of my way for the statuary, but the cards that you put in to enable the statuary also generate tokens, like the Cogworker's Puzzle Knot, the Birth of Meletus that makes like a artifact wall, is that right?
Yep, it is a wall. It is an artifact.
You're getting a good density of artifacts that also happen to enable Transmogrify, so now you have two different paths to the big payoff. And if Agent of Treachery is that payoff, you know, sure, I suppose that makes sense. But I'm just wondering if the statuary is like the weak link. Like, I almost wonder if you just cut that card and have a better deck.
I mean, you need to play a mana engine in these decks because they are clunky. So you either have to play this or Fighters. I don't think you can play just a straight up like Jeskai list without either of those two. I don't think you're going to get enough value out of it. So you can play Fighters. I mean, you could play Fighters with a very similar shell. And just add Transmogrify to it. The problem is you don't get the instant speed like trigger ever because Fires just shuts down the super cool Teferi Transmogrify interaction. But
why do you need a mana engine? Or isn't Transmogrify itself your another kind of mana engine? It cheats you up the curve.
Yeah, I mean, and then you just wouldn't play Urion.
I mean, you probably still would. I'm just You know, this is not a deck that's like full of card draw or something. I think you could easily run out of things to spend the mana on, even if you got the statuary down into play. I'm just like not sure why this archetype needs a mana engine. Even like Jeskai Luka Fires would sometimes side out its fires in certain matchups.
Well, I mean, fires got banned, so I mean, it got sided out in certain matchups because of how it interacted with an entire format bent around that mirror match. So I think in a that you're not siding out fires in actual Pioneer. That's not a thing that's happening. I don't think the Fire's decks are ever doing that. I think you need the mana engine because you need to start double spelling, because the actual like 1-for-1 removal is quite inefficient. And because you're playing all these token makers, whether it's the Jeskai Fires list or this list, all these cards are sort of like minor advantage kind of pieces, but you're not playing enough to the board. So you often find yourself quite far behind. So you'll find the interaction you'll have with Fire's decks is you feel like you're kind of ahead. And then they need to have like a crucial turn off and on 5 or 6 where they double spell and then the game functionally ends the next turn. But they're basically losing for like most of the game until they do that. And they collect their 12 mana on turn 6 kind of a deal.
Yeah, Orthright Line's 18 mana on turn 6. That's the crazy part about how that deck can work. I mean, to me, like, my money would be that the traditional Jeskai Fires Luka deck and Pioneer is just the better deck. But we try new things out, and sometimes we learn things from it. So, for example, Dan mentioned how Inspiring Statuary is just a fractional value of Urza. Well, it turns out this deck also plays Karn, Sign of Urza, who is another third of Urza. And after a second downtick, is maybe two-thirds of Urza. And somehow the signs are going to be pretty huge in this deck because you're playing a bunch of cheap artifacts to go with Inspiring Statuary. Is this better than what you get out of a more Fires build that can play more of the Omen cards and Elspeth Conqueror's Death the extra slots? Maybe not, but there is an interesting thing going on here with those cards working together.
Yeah, it's like Moneyball, right? You can't replace Giambi. You replace him in the aggregate for any Brad Pitt fans out there, or Michael Lewis fans, I guess.
All right, so question that is occurring to me now. Why does the Jeskai Luka Fires deck not play Transmogrify?
I don't know. I'm not a Jeskai Luka aficionado. I just crush them a lot with various other decks I make. I think because the instant speed can never be used. But I mean, if they just play 4 Luka and that's enough of that effect for them, I'm not sure. That kind of surprised me when I looked at all the lists. I didn't see it in any of them. I didn't see it in any of the standard lists either. So
yeah, I mean, there's a question that says, like, in this type of deck, is Luka better than Transmogrify? In the sense that, sure, it costs one more mana, but you can use it twice, just 2 straight downticks. In theory, you can uptick, and use it 3 times. You run out of agents at some point, actually pretty quickly. And so that alone may make it sort of a little bit better than Transmogrify, the second use.
Yeah, I'm guessing it has something to do with, you know, the choice of Agent of Treachery as a payoff is also one that, you know, it kind of needs multiple uses. So Urien goes a long way towards giving you that extra flicker, and then if Urien is also flickering the Luka, or just Luka naturally has another -2, you know, you're way ahead when you get your first agent, but then like you really put the nail in the coffin when you do it a second and third time. Whereas if you just had Transmogrify, you'd just probably just get one agent. And that might not be enough to win. So maybe if the deck was built around some other big creature, like there is no Crater of Behemoth, right? That just wouldn't work. Enraze, Forerunners, it's just not going to work. There isn't really like a Gristlebrand class creature in Pioneer, at least. And that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, I think Agent of Treachery is a totally fine top end. And like I've said, it's actually been quite bad. It's been a card I've been bending my various decks to get into play, and then getting a 1-mana 1/2 prowess creature for all that effort. It's a bitter pill to swallow sometimes.
All right. Well, we'll try out the Transmogrify build and see what our tokens become, and we'll report back on that next week.
Yeah. So up next, we have See the Truth. As a quick refresher, it's 1 and a blue for a sorcery. And the front half of it is you look at the top 3 cards of your library, put 1 into your hand and the rest on the bottom. And it's not only a back half, but it's just if you cast it from anywhere other than your hand, you just draw those 3 cards, which is worth, as we discussed, 500 life or more in terms of power of that effect, drawing 3 cards. So you get the straight up recall effect for only 1 and a blue. So still not as good as recall, but you have to cast it from not your hand. And so as a result, I have not in my career as a magician seen the truth even once. But in an attempt to do so, we have David has a list for Pioneer. What do you have?
So yeah, the question first becomes, do you want to use it in Modern or do you want to use it in Pioneer? The advantage of Modern specifically is the card Snapcaster Mage. This is a card that sees a lot of play for various reasons. I don't need to describe why Snapcaster Mage is good. But there's a very similar card in Ancestral Visions that is used and cheated to be cast in a bunch of different ways. And so the sorcery speed nature of the See the Truth interaction, I think, is just a little too weak. And there's a bunch of like close enough versions of blue decks doing that. I don't think you need to bend your deck to do that in a positive way. So I was like, all right, maybe it will see some play in Pioneer. Let's see what we can do. The issue there for me is Treasure Cruise is a way to draw three cards for probably not that much mana that also uses your graveyard a little bit. So you have to find a way to make See the Truth more attractive than Treasure Cruise. Or you could play both, which I'm actually doing. I do have a Treasure Cruise in this list. So one of the effects I really want to try out, which is a card I loved, was Goblin Dark Dwellers. This is a card that hasn't seen any play at all in Pioneer. It saw some play in Modern back in the day, even back when Jund was a terror and people were kind of going over each other. So just as a quick reminder, this is 3 red-red for a 4/4 menace. And when it comes into play, you may cast an instant or sorcery in your graveyard that costs 3 or less. So that's See the Truth. So if Goblin Dark Dwellers enters play, you're getting a 5-mana 4/4 that draws 3 cards, 5-mana 4/4 menace. And this deck has a bunch of different ways to put this in the graveyard, including Jacefern's Prodigy, which also is a card that threatens to cast See the Truth from the graveyard. And again, get your twice as bad as Ancestral, but still playable, draw 3. And then the rest of the deck is kind of trying to build, I hope Damon will forgive me here, like a bad version of like Blue Moon in Pioneer, such as it is. We don't see like blue-red mid-range lists, I think for a very good reason. They don't have a lot of tools to handle certain permanents. Because we have lots of discard, I'm playing Riel the Everwise. There were cards I wanted to play anyway, so like Censor is just one of the few cheap ways that blue-red has to interact with kind of any permanent in the early game. In the late game, it turns into, you know, a relatively powerful card with Riel the Everwise. Neutralize is a card I've had a lot of success with in these kind of mid-range shells. And then you just kind of fill in the rest of the deck with like instant speed interaction. And you're counting on these, you know, kind of big heavy hitters, whether it be a Goblin Dark Dwellers, your Treasure Cruise, or Jace Flashing Back See the Truth. Just like fill up your hand, or if Riel goes unanswered, that's another huge card advantage engine. And then everything else just kind of tries to trade one for one around that.
So I'm reminded of our conversations about Frantic Inventory when we were trying out Teferi Master of Time. Both from the same set, right? And the Frantic Inventory, the problem was like hard casting the first one. And then like, will you find a second and third copies to pay you off for all the time you spent and the deck slots you used trying to set up what would hopefully eventually be a draw 3? See the Truth kind of makes a similar bargain. Like eventually you might get a draw 3, but until then you're going to be, you know, casting a slow anticipate. So it's kind of like finding a strategy that is okay with that. And it looks like what you have here, you know, this deck doesn't have a lot that it's trying to do on 2 mana, although there's some tension between playing the See the Truth on turn 2, playing a Jace Fringe Prodigy, or leaving mana up for like a Censor or something. But yeah, it's in no rush to get anything going. And then eventually, when you get to the Dark Dwellers time, you get your draw 3. But do you think that just like the front half of this card is like on rate, or how big of a sacrifice is it to have to just cast this and get one card?
I'm hoping to never cast this ever. I would literally rather leave 2 mana up and bluff a Censor, or is it Charm, than cast it. I will eventually draw a Royal Scions, a Jace Fringe Prodigy, or a Teferi Master of Time. And it will do my job for me. I'm hoping to never cast it. Or to cast it when I have like 6 mana up or whatever, and I'm looking specifically for my one neutralizer or whatever. Then I can stomach it. But I'm, unless, you know, my opponent's just leading on like tap land or whatever, I'm really hoping to never cast it.
I claim the card would be Modern playable if it was an instant. And that's just because, like, anticipate is not that bad of a cantrip. And playing this at sorcery speed is certainly a major, major problem because you can't play your Censor or just keep up removal. But it's not a bad card to cast in the sense that it helps you dig towards sideboard cards in games 2 and 3. helps you dig towards the cards you need to cast it outside of your hand. So I'm not as down on casting it on the front half as you guys are. I do wonder, though, if there's a way to build this deck that's much more like an Is It Phoenix deck, where you play cards like Finale of Promise to be casting your See the Truth, and using that in turn to flip Arclight Phoenix back into play. In the sense that I'm just very concerned that you play a Jace Friend's Prodigy, you know, being like, aha, I'm going to get five cards in my library, flip my Jace, and then cast See the Truth off Jace's downtick. And of course, Jace is going to get pushed 9 times out of 10, in my experience. I feel like Pioneer right now is very hostile to playing four Jace main deck. And meanwhile, Arclight Phoenix is a recurring threat, and the See the Truth lines just involve casting a lot of spells. And drawing three cards, if you don't, you know, do it some clever way with Finale Promise, drawing three cards that in a deck with this many cheap spells, it will just let you naturally cast a bunch of cards to bring back the Phoenix or flip a thing in the ice or what have you.
I've seen that tried, and it didn't really impress me. I think the problem is that, you know, the Phoenix deck already doesn't really want these two mana draw effects. And if you're willing to spend two for an effect, you can get more than See the Truth. You know, strategic planning just does more than See the Truth for setting up what Phoenix is trying to do, because it's trying to set up Treasure Cruises, you know, the actual one mana draw three. So that's kind of the problem, at least when you have access to the full Pioneer card pool. It's just not quite good enough at that. So I actually feel like David's deck is at the right speed for taking advantage of See the Truth. But I'm curious, now that you mentioned Finale of Promise, what about like Electro Dominance? Is that a card you guys would consider as another way to like get the See the Truth for three cards?
Does that work? Let's just start with that question.
I believe it will work, yeah. So Electro Dominance, it's a bad burn spell, and then it also lets you cast a card. No, it does not. Gosh. All right, so let's not do that. Let's do Finale of Promise. Or let's just not do that.
Another card is Chandra, Acolyte of Flame, has a downtick that lets you cast a spell with CMC 3 or less, but you have to pay mana for it on Link Up and Dark Dwellers. So if you want to do it all in one shot, you have to have 5 mana. So you don't get a discount, but you can do it over 2 turns. On the other hand, a shell like this, I'm not sure you really want to be playing Chandra.
Interesting. Littlest Chandra. So it's a difficult card, See the Truth, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I'm not actually sure the card is playable. This is the kind of shell that wants it a little bit more than Treasure Cruise, though, specifically because I think Goblin Dark Dwellers, like, you're a reactive control deck until you get to the point where Goblin Dark Dwellers is like a whammy. It's a tap-out card that's actually worth what they let a 5-mana Planeswalker do basically these days. So you don't feel as bad. If you tap out and do this and they tap out and play Teferi, you're not hopelessly behind.
Is Mission Briefing just completely forgettable?
Again, Mission Briefing has to happen at sorcery speed because See the Truth is only castable at sorcery speed. I thought about adding a Teferi to this deck literally just to like plus it and cast See the Truth at instant speed. You just end up taking so much damage from your mana, and that's really the only white card you want to play. Except for maybe a couple of cyborg cards, but maybe that's worth doing. I mean,
yeah, I mean, you have great mana. You have all these cantrips.
If you don't mind shocking yourself a lot, then you can have great mana, absolutely.
I mean, the power of wedge colors with Triumphs is hard to understate. You just jam 4 Rogren Triumphs in here.
All right, well, the truth about See the Truth remains to be seen. We will check that out and report back on our findings next week. To round things out, we talk about the card Discontinuity from M21. It's 3 blue, instant. End the turn, which is the same text as Time Stop. It exiles everything from the stack. It goes directly to the cleanup phase. So it's kind of a Time Stop, but it has a cost reduction. As long as it's your turn, this spell only costs 1 and a blue to cast. It's reduced by 4. So what can we do with this?
Not die to our Demonic Pact?
Yeah, you can always do that. So one thing that I really liked about this is it has an interaction with Lotus Field. So when Lotus Field comes into play, it comes into play tapped, and a trigger goes on the stack that says sacrifice 2 lands. So the 2 lands that you're going to sacrifice, if one of them taps for a blue and one of them taps for any other color, you can just cast this continuity, and it functions as a 2-mana ramp spell. In addition to that, it interacts very positively with Uro. You can cast Uro, get your positive trigger. So let's say you have 4 mana in play. You cast Uro, you play your extra land for the turn and gain 3 life and draw a card. And then you can cast Discontinuity, and it stops the transition of Uro to your graveyard. So you don't have to play cards that I have grown to really dislike, like Satyr Wayfinder or whatever, to fill up your graveyard. you can just play Uro on the front side as a 3-mana 6/6 that threatens to, you know, attack on the next turn. And it's not like you're going down a card, it's drawing you a card, but you're casting discontinuity, so you're staying even on that front. The rest of the deck is just sort of in the modern design of decks these days, where you're just playing a shit ton of lands, and then you're just ramping into these big beaters. Cura Behemoth Beckoner interacts positively with Uro, and it interacts very positively with Lotus Field. So at minus ones, do generate 3 mana, so that helps your ramp. You've got a bunch of super expensive spells here. Arboreal Grazer and Growth Spiral both pay you off for having all these extra lands. I did sneak one Dragonlord Ojutai in here. It's awesome with Teferi, Time Raveler, and Kiora. So they can't target it when it attacks. Kiora can untap it, so it can't ever be targeted. You have like a 2 of Fae of Wishes because you just have all this mana lying around. So you can have like Ugin and Wrath of Gods and a bunch of like silver bullets in your sideboard. And then I just included a couple Shark Typhoons because if you've got a bunch of mana, you might as well just make a super huge shark at the end of their turn.
Yeah, so Discontinuity has a lot of the cool tricks that we've been intrigued by with Sundial of the Infinite, which also ends the turn on your turn. And I think I talked about a really cool Turbo Titans list that Lanny Huang, one of our listeners, had taken to some success in the Modern Leagues a few months back. And I actually got it 2-4-1s with it. Just, it was such a great feeling to play an Uro or even a Kruxa and then just end the turn with a trigger on the stack. So you just get it. Discontinuity is a little more finicky. You can't like lock it in like you can with Sundial of the Infinite. So I think it's a little more, you have to be willing to accept all the different modes of this card, which could be, you know, just the full 6 mana end their turn or something.
Yeah, and in a ramp deck, I mean, that's not the craziest thing, where all of a sudden, it's not as good as a Time Walk because they still get to untap and cast Instants. If you do it during their upkeep, you can kind of go for the risky line where you like try to do it in response to them tapping out for something big, so they both lose the big spell and are tapped out when you go back to your turn. That's a very interesting kind of game theoretic decision to make, so I'm not actually sure which way you wind up doing it. But the fact that it has like a floor of, once you get to 6 mana, of basically being a Time Walk is like pretty compelling.
Yeah, and this Lotus Field line is one that, you know, I think when we looked at the card brought back almost a year ago now, that wasn't the same release as Lotus Field, and we kind of toyed around with the interaction, right? Just turn 3, you play your Lotus Field, you have 2 mana up. What do you do with that mana? That's enough to cast a brought back and get your 2 lands back. Discontinuity, I didn't even think of this until, David, you described it here. It's like, wow, gosh, that's like the same effect, right? So you're talking about even like not having to do anything in the first 2 turns. Suddenly you go from 2 mana up to 5 mana, and then like next turn you're casting a Shark Typhoon or whatever. That's pretty cool.
And if you just want to like live in magical Christmas land, you can go Arboreal Grazer, play your second land. On turn 3, you can do what you're saying before they could interact with it in any way, right? They're just playing a mana and doing whatever. So then on your turn 3, you're untapping with 6 mana. And the number of things you can do in that scenario, like you can play a Kiora, it immediately untaps, so Kiora plays for free in that scenario. And then any, you know, Hydroid Crisis, Ojutai, your Uro, all trigger, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, like most ramp decks, I think you're kind of always wanting to live in magical Christmas land where you draw your ramp early and then your beaters once you have all your mana in play. You aren't playing Opt or anything like that. Growth Spiral, obviously, we don't need to speak too much on that. People who've been playing a lot of Standard are aware of how powerful that card is. So I've never like designed a deck like this. This was sort of looking at how like Standard people were kind of constructing their deck with their land drops and stuff and trying to sort of build
something. Yeah, I'm wondering if we should borrow some of the Lotus Field technology and play Thespian Stage too.
Yeah, at least a couple.
Yeah, I mean, you have 29 lands. You have a lot of room for that for sure. You just want to make sure you've got a ton of green that comes into play untapped on turn 1. As long as you're hitting like 17 or 18 of that and you have enough white and blue to do all the other stuff you need to do, then yeah, you should definitely play some number of Thespian Stage.
Yeah, the one downside of Discontinuity is that when you hard cast it, it exiles itself. So there's no shenanigans to be had in terms of like looping it with Torrential Gearhulks or anything. It's basically a one-shot tool, and that means that you do need to find room in your deck for like something else that actually wins. So David, I think you're having your Uros, your Hydroid Crises, your Shark Typhoons are doing that work. Plus you have the Fae of Wishes, I suppose. Ojutai. Yeah, so this is like a grab bag of stuff, and we hope that wins. I feel like it has a decent shot at winning. We'll have to find out, you know, go toe-to-toe with Niv-Mizzet and see which deck comes out ahead. So that's our task for the week. Which of these three appeals to you guys the most? Which ones do you think you want to try out?
I'm a sucker for the blue-red deck, so I'd like to try some variant of the See the Truth list.
I think for me, it's going to be the ramp deck. I want to live that, chase that feeling, Uro and the turn. So I'll start with that. And David, I guess that leaves you with the Inspiring Statuary Transmogrify list.
Yeah, I guess. There's no other options. It'll be fun.
I also have a sweet Discontinuity of Aegirok Chance for Glory deck, but that might have to wait until next week. Just kidding. I've learned my lesson on that card.
Yeah. These are, you know, open-ended cards in many respects, and we're just kicking the tires on them, still scratching the surface. So any listeners have some cool ideas for them, be sure to let us know, and maybe we'll give them a try. That being said, I think that brings us to the end of episode 68 of Faithless Brewing. Thanks everyone for hanging out, and we'll see you guys next week. All right, that's it for this week. As always, you can find the deck list from this episode in the episode descriptions in your podcast player or on our homepage, faithlessbrewing.podbean.com. While you're out there on the World Wide Web, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG and leave us a 5-star review wherever you listen to your pods. If you would like to support the show, you can join our Patreon, where supporting us at any tier gets you a number of rewards and thank yous. You get Discord access, you get access to our extended show notes, you can send us listener questions, participate in our community leagues, and much more. At the higher tiers, we have merchandise, our playmats are available, and we have our custom tokens on the way. You can find all the details on how to sign up at patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. We would love to see you there. That's it for us. Stay safe, happy brewing, and we will see you next week.